the Journal of the American Society for Psychical Research. It seems to me quite impossible to find a single flaw in this wonderful result. But my object is to record scientifically that they do occur, that they are part of the phenomena of nature, and that science, which is the search of truth and for knowledge, can only ignore them at the deadly peril of its own future existence as a guiding force for the world. This séance is, for me, the culminating point of all my psychical research. I can now say, if I so desire, nunc dimittis, and go on with my own legitimate entomological work. I can only ask that you and your whole family will accept my statement as absolute truth, knowing me as you do. To Dr. Crandon and his wife, this remarkable testimony, by one who until a few years ago was a complete unbeliever, must be a source of great gratification, as, like all pioneers, Dr. and Mrs. Crandon have had to suffer the jeers of the ignorant. He, however, bravely risked his great reputation, believing that truth must ultimately conquer, and that to follow truth wherever it may lead is the only course an honest man can adopt. What happened in Dr. Tillyard's presence has happened in the presence of hundreds of people, who have experienced the same results with this lady. Consequently, Dr. Tillyard's experience is only typical of many others, carried out with same precautions and scientific care. It is now possible to discuss psychic phenomena at a dinner table, at one's club, or in a railway train, without being made to feel that your friends look upon you with sincere pity as one so sensible in other ways, but somewhat unbalanced in this direction. I trust, therefore, that what I am about to relate will receive more consideration than was accorded to the writings of some who have gone before me. Evidence, cumulative evidence, and still more evidence will in the end win the day. With this weapon the walls of ignorance and antagonism are being brought low, and there is no stronger tool available to complete destruction than the evidence of survival obtained by the direct or independent voice. Both names for this phenomenon are used, and they refer to the phenomenon of voice production and speech from some intelligence quite apart from any being in the flesh. 35. The direct voice is the highest psychical phenomenon yet discovered, and it is the most convincing besides being quite the most wonderful. All the other discoveries of man fade into insignificance when compared with this great discovery. The discovery of a direct method of communication between us and the departed, not by means of raps or taps, but by the most intimate of all forms of communication, the human voice. Other forms of psychic phenomena can be simulated by a fraudulent medium, but the direct voice at its best cannot be. Often have I, and others with me, heard two and sometimes three separate voices of different tone and personality speaking to those present at one and the same time, on different topics, known only to the person addressed, while the medium was either talking on some other subject to the person sitting next him, or I had my ear close up to his mouth and not a sound was proceeding from his lips. From instances which I shall give, telepathy, cryptaesthesia and the other explanations given by some to account for psychic phenomena, can be ruled out. A clear-cut issue lies before the inquirer, and I know of no one who has been privileged to experience the direct voice at its best, who has been able to come to any other conclusion than that the voices come from those who once lived here on earth, and who, having passed through death, now return to tell us that there is, in reality, no death but a fuller life of steady development and progression in an etheric world which interpenetrates this earth of ours. In concluding this introduction to the subject, I wish to say, with all the strength at my command, that there is continuity of life, that nothing is lost, and life is no exception. Communication between those now living in bodies covered with physical matter, and those who have carded their physical bodies is not only possible, but takes place under suitable conditions. My results have been obtained by creating those conditions, conditions which made it possible for the discarnate to resume speech with the incarnate. It has been my privilege on many occasions to carry on conversations and discussions with those who have passed on to the fuller life, or to hear them carried on with those present along with me. Hundreds of different voices have I heard, and hundreds of facts have I and they been given to prove that those who spoke were in reality those they claimed to be. From these conversations I have learned much, not only of the continuance of life, but also of the conditions of life in this etheric world about and around us, and of the methods employed for communication. Much of what I was told I could not comprehend or understand, and, even after the devotion of much thought to the question over the past 12 years, I feel more than ever the profundity of it all. Before, however, giving my records of some of these conversations, let me lead the reader on step by step, as a proper grasp of the subject can only be obtained by our having one foot securely placed on the first step before moving on to the next. The first step is a consideration of that little understood, but vastly important something, known to science as the ether, which is believed to fill all space and is the medium of light, as well as of the sounds which come from our wireless transmitter. Until we understand a little of this invisible but very real thing, and how limited are our normal sense perceptions, it is useless even to attempt to get an intelligent understanding of the phenomena which occur in the séance room. This being so, my next chapter must be considered as a further introduction to the subject under discussion. Chapter 2, The Universe of Ether. The vast interplanetary and interstellar regions will no longer be regarded as waste places in the universe. We shall find them to be already full of this wonderful medium, so full that no human power can remove it from the smallest portion of space, or produce the slightest flaw in its infinite continuity. Clerk Maxwell. Reality is what everyone is keen to know about. No one wants to be deceived, all are eager for trustworthy information, if it be forthcoming, about both the material and the spiritual worlds, which together seem to constitute the universe. The ether of space is the connecting link. In the material world it is the fundamental, substantial reality. In the spiritual world the realities of existence are other and far higher, but still the ether is made use of in ways which at present we can only surmise. Lodge. 37. We live and move and have our being in a physical world which is composed of substances vibrating within certain fixed limits, to which we give the name matter. We are born into it, and we accept it as if it comprised everything. Yet how different things are from what they seem to be. Our ideas of the physical things about us change from age to age. Each generation imagines the absolute has been reached in knowledge, and yet history is just the story of the development of the human mind in relation to its surroundings. At no stage can it be said that the sum of human knowledge has been reached. One discovery is followed by another, and each time it is thought that the universe has no further secrets to yield up to man, that human inquiry has at last reached its limit. Then some new idea based on further knowledge is put forward, somewhat timidly to begin with, to be first scorned, then considered and finally accepted. So life has developed, mentally, from its primitive condition up to the present day. At every stage the mind has been able to take a larger grasp of its environment. To life, at its beginning, the sea in its immediate vicinity, through which it floated, was its universe, its all. That constituted all that could be grasped by the mind of Paleozoic life. By slow, unsteady steps both body and mind developed, through the fish stage to the reptile, and so on, until the being called man arrived. This creature, by developing his mind as well as his muscles, became in time the dominant power on earth. By a slow and painful path his development has proceeded, many of his failures and his mistakes he has remembered, most of the knowledge he has acquired he has not forgotten, and today he finds himself developed mentally and physically to a higher degree than ever before. We have certainly found the means of controlling physical matter to a greater degree than ever before, but the question now comes as to whether this achievement is the goal of humanity. We now understand its laws and functions, but is this the end of human endeavor? As we were thinking that this was so, there comes a new discovery. 38. We are now told that just as our forefathers were wrong in their astronomy and had to recast their views, so must we readjust our ideas regarding this physical matter about which we thought we knew and understood so much. Matter which looks so solid is in reality not solid at all. What we see when we look at a table or a chair, for instance, are the vibrations of a certain number of electrons, which are revolving at immense speed around a center known as the nucleus. Matter is made up of atoms, and these atoms are in turn composed of electrons and protons. According to the number of electrons in an atom, so is the substance, but the weight is conditioned by the number of protons. The number of planetary electrons in any element is given by its atomic number, but in addition to these there are electrons fixed in the nucleus, equivalent to the supplement of its atomic weight, and these are liable to vary in different isotopes. The atomic number for iron is 26, while its atomic weight is a whole number somewhere about 56. Therefore, in iron there are always 26 planetary electrons, and in normal iron there are 30 in addition, though in some isotopes there may be 31 and in others 29. Consequently, when we look at or handle something composed of the foregoing, we sense something to which we have given the name of iron, or, to put it correctly, when our eye is affected by the ether vibrations its electrons create, we create the mental image of iron. Our touch is likewise affected by the vibrations these electrons produce, and they give us the effect of heat and cold, but the number of protons give us the sense of weight. Sir Oliver Lodge, in Ether and Reality, puts it as follows. We can now summarize briefly what we know. The two oppositely charged particles, the negative and the positive, are called respectively an electron and a proton. They are both exceedingly minute, and there is a sense in which their size has been measured. They are far smaller than atoms, incomparably smaller, the smallest things known. Even if there were 100 or 1,000 of them in the atom, they would not be in the least crowded, there would be plenty of empty space. Different atoms are now known to be composed of a different number of electrons, and by their different number and grouping they constitute the different chemical elements. The atoms of all the chemical elements are built of electrons and protons and of nothing else. On this view, the existence of an electron can be fairly understood. Can the existence of a proton be understood too? Number there we are in a difficulty. The proton is more massive than can easily be accounted for, and why it is more massive we can only guess. Indeed, at present we can hardly guess, or at least the guesses are not very satisfactory. That remains at present an outstanding puzzle. The question is one that has hardly yet been faced. One guess is that the electron is hollow, like a bubble, that it has an electric field which by itself would cause the bubble to expand, but that it is kept in equilibrium and of a certain size by the etheric pressure. On this view there is no substance in its interior. In itself such an electron is not massive at all, its apparent mass is due to its electric field and to nothing else. Whereas the interior of a proton, instead of being hollow, may be fulfilled with an extra ether, all that which was removed from the electron being crammed into the proton, so as to account for its great massiveness or what we may call its weight. A proton is more than 1,000 times as heavy as an electron, about 1,840 times by direct measurements, and what is called the atomic weight, or the weight of an atom, depends almost entirely on the weight of the protons it contains. The hydrogen atom contains only 1, the helium atom contains 4, the lithium atom 7, the oxygen atom 16, and so on, in accordance with the list of atomic weights long empirically known in chemistry, the heaviest being uranium, which contains 238. The atomic weights are certain enough, the number of protons in a specified atom is fairly certain also. What is not known is why the proton has such a weight, and why the weight of an electron is so much less. In every other respect the two charges seem equal and opposite, electrically they are equal and opposite. We are safe in saying that the weight of matter depends on the protons, that is the positive units, which go to form the nucleus of the atom, while the chemical properties of the atom depend on the electrons which circulate round the nucleus. These planetary electrons are active and energetic, and produce conspicuous results. They characterize the atom by its spectrum, they confer on it its chemical properties, but they add to its weight hardly at all. It is a curious state of things, but the evidence for it, so far, is good. Physical matter is in reality an open network of electrons and protons, and the distance between the electrons and the protons in an individual atom, in relation to its size, is immense. If we consider the nucleus as commanding the same position in an atom as the Sun does in our solar system, then the relative distance the electrons are apart from one another and from the protons might be taken as equivalent to the distance the planets are from each other and from the Sun. If we consider an atom as something the size of a village church, then a pinhead would represent the relative size of one of the electrons of which it is composed. These protons and electrons in the atoms are thus far asunder, moving at enormous speed, and they are linked together by this invisible ether which occupies much the greater space within the atom. Matter is thus constructed of minute electric charges, both positive and negative, not moving haphazardly, but freely and orderly, and connected together by the invisible ether, which is now believed to be the basic substance of the universe. What then do we know of this invisible ether? We imagine it filling all space, though, as we cannot grasp space, we are unable to comprehend its extent. We know, however, that the ether waves can undulate through space at the rate of 186,000 miles a second, which undulations, or waves, give us what we term light. Under certain circumstances, the vibrating energy of these waves of ether can be translated into equivalent energies of heat and electricity. Though we cannot see the ether yet, we infer that such a substance exists, because heat, light and electricity travel through space at a definite rate, and therefore there must be a medium through which they undulate. Our physicists therefore argue that the ether is a pragmatic hypothesis, a logical postulate. The ether has never been seen nor weighed as an actual substance, yet certain tentative conclusions have been come to concerning its character and properties. It fills all space, it is 500 degrees colder than the temperature of the Earth, it has inertia and momentum, it exercises pressure, and has density and elasticity and a perpetual squirming motion. Later experiments may modify this conception of this wonderful substance, which in itself we can neither see, hear, smell nor touch, and, when thrown into vibration, can carry across space the energy which is capable of entering our consciousness as light, heat and electricity. Only recently we have discovered how to transform these waves into words and music. This undulating substance is never at rest and is always in movement. Though it has never been seen or touched, yet if it were non-existent we would be blind and cold, as there would be no medium to carry the waves which set up vibrations in our eyes and in our skins. This amazing substance is the medium between things material and our senses, but matter is now considered to be this same ether in certain fixed states of vibration. The electrons in the atoms are particles of negative electricity and the protons are certainly electric their nature. Both are etheric, and matter is only ether in a particular condition. All ether is potentially matter and all matter potentially ether. Physical matter, which appeals to our senses, is only that section of the ether which happens to be vibrating within certain fixed limits. In this book I differentiate between the two substances, physical matter on the one hand, which we can sense, and this etheric substance which is beyond our sense perceptions. Yet, though beyond our perception, it is not beyond our capacity to understand, at least in some degree. In fact, our understanding of it has increased so much in recent years that the whole tendency of physical science today is towards the view that not physical but this etheric substance is the basic structure of the universe. The ether of space can now be taken as the one great unifying link between the world of matter and that which we term etheric, as it is the substance common to both worlds. Both are contained within this substance, both are part of it, and both are formed out of it. The two worlds are part of the same universe, and life in both is conditioned by it. Here, in this world of matter in which we function, we are only conscious of a lower scale of vibrations, whereas in the etheric world, where life also functions, consciousness is affected by a higher scale of vibrations. The ether is as much to other life in the universe as it is to us. To this other life, its surroundings are just as substantial and real as ours are to us. Life functions in the ether, and it is just as much able to do so when free of matter as it is when clothed in matter. In fact, a fuller, larger life can be imagined when the physical body is discarded, As we proceed, these views will be better appreciated, as in my conversations with those in this further life, which I shall report, it will be seen that they tell me that the etheric world is just as real, just as tangible, just as beautiful, in fact more so, than the world of physical matter which appeals to our limited sense perceptions. Only the ignorant affirm that just what we sense is real, that beyond this range of sense nothing exists. Our range of sense, our sight, our touch, our smell and hearing are limited to the last degree. We know that the spectrum of the spectroscope proves the very limited range of our ordinary vision, and that further ranges of vibrations of what would be color, could we see them, extend on either side. It has been said that the perceived vibrations as compared with the unperceived are much less than is an inch to a mile. It is evident that there lies an enormous region for other life to inhabit around and within this world of ours, a region quite beyond our normal sense perceptions. See chart facing introduction. Until we clearly understand that our senses here only respond to a very limited range of vibrations, namely those we term physical matter, that outside these there is a universe full of life, which responds to a higher range of vibrations, unreal to us, but more real to it than physical matter, we cannot grasp or understand in all its fullness the psychical phenomena which develop through mediumship. All my life these deeper problems of life and death have interested me. I remember at school passing a horse in a field and lying beside it was a dead foal, and I wondered then, as I have wondered often since, what had actually taken place to change what the day previously was an active moving piece of substance to one that was now inert and still. These thoughts have occurred to everyone from time to time, and they can be continued right through the entire range of living substances. What is the cause of a tree in full bloom retaining its shape and its leaves, while another which is called dead, breaks in pieces at a touch and crumbles away into dust? There must be a something, too, which we give the term life, which animates the living organism, and is absent in the dead organism. That something has the power to give the substance form and expression, whereas, when the something is absent, form and expression go, and the substance which was previously animated returns to form part of the earth. It is, therefore, evident that there is something we cannot see or handle, and yet is real and powerful, which has this faculty of creating forms out of inanimate earth. I say it must be powerful, because it is capable of raising matter contrary to the force of gravity, and retaining matter in an erect position, as, when it leaves the substance, the force of gravity again assumes control and the substance in question is affected by all the forces of nature. A man, an animal, a tree, can stand erect when this life force permeates them, but when it does not they fall to the ground. Life, therefore, is an organizing force which can counteract the tendency in matter to disorganize itself. Life is a formative, thinking force, entering matter and arranging it, whereas matter without it is inert and devoid of personality. Life, therefore, cannot be a part of matter any more than the potter can be a part of the clay he uses in his molds, and besides this it has personality. Every living thing has personality, as every living thing is different from every other living thing. This life force, by this process of arguing, has powers quite beyond the powers attributed to matter. It is more powerful than matter. It can organize matter, and therefore thinks. Besides that it has individuality. Consequently we can safely take a further step forward, and say that this organizing force is influenced by mind and that this which we call mind must be the living, active, dominating, controlling force in the universe. Mind controls life and life controls matter. Death can therefore be described as a severance of mind from its association with matter. And it would be illogical to conclude that mind and its vehicle, the etheric body, which have such power over matter, cease to exist when we lose sight of their organizing powers. Though we do not see mind at work, it is logical and reasonable to assume that it continues to control this etheric substance elsewhere. Matter we know can be changed, but never destroyed. Consequently, it is safe to assume that what can control matter likewise cannot be destroyed. 44. This general argument, had we not direct evidence, might never lead us to anything tangible. We might always be right in assuming the indestructibility of mind, and its expression, life, but had psychic phenomena not come to our aid, we would have been only halfway to our goal. The goal, however, has now been reached, and the path has been prepared for the human mind to travel the whole road. Logically, it is a reasonable assumption that mind should continue to exist after death, apart from its association with matter, but now we have the proof from psychic science that this does so happen, and that the etheric body which survives is the real body and the one which holds the physical body together during life on earth. Death, I am told, is as easy and as simple as going to sleep and then awakening. Our etheric body slips out of the physical body, carrying the mind with it, and we awake to our new surroundings to find our friends and relations ready to help and instruct us in our new life. Death is simply the severance of this etheric body, or structure, from the physical body. The physical body returns to earth, and the etheric body, controlled by the mind, continues to function in the etheric world which, though within and also without the physical, cannot be appreciated by us so long as we are inhabitants of the physical body. Our range of sight and touch is too confined for us to appreciate these finer vibrations. Individuality therefore continues apart from physical matter, and we still think apart from the physical because the same mind which functioned, when associated with the physical body, now does so through the duplicate etheric body. We therefore continue to exist as separate thinking units in the etheric world, much as we do today, but with new surroundings. With the same capacity for expanding thought as we have here, our minds develop, and probably develop more rapidly apart from physical matter. It will be seen from the conversations I have had with those who have passed on, that our etheric bodies are similar to our present bodies, and that is the logical conclusion when we admit what has been said before, namely that the etheric holds the physical particles together. This etheric body, moreover, has weight as well as form, as weight is only a question of degree. In the etheric world, weight, which in the physical is determined by gravity, must be determined by some other force of a like nature. 45. We shall therefore have weight, form, individuality and the same mind then as we have now, but what of our surroundings? As to these, we can accept what we are told in these communications from the etheric world, as we can make certain logical deductions based on our physical surroundings. We are informed that the etheric world is similar to this world. Our world is composed of individuals, and other living things which are animated by a force we term life, controlled by mind. It is therefore not unreasonable to conclude that this force, combined with mind, which has the power to act on physical matter, and produce what we experience in the physical world, has the same power to influence etheric matter to produce trees, animals and other living forms, similar to those we have in the physical world. Therefore it is not unreasonable to believe that the etheric world contains trees, animals and flowers, being to all intents and purposes similar to this world, and that when we make the change called death we shall find ourselves in a world very much like the one we live in today, except that we shall not be encumbered by physical matter. Consequently our mind will be more active, and our thoughts and movements quicker. In this chapter one have tried to take the reader one step further forward. Reference is frequently made in later chapters to vibrations, and a general knowledge that the universe is nothing more nor less than ether in different states of vibration is essential if we are to understand the new world about which it is my intention to tell you. Until I was able to grasp the fact that here in this physical world of ours we sensed ether only at certain fixed rates of vibration, and that these were infinitesimal compared with its other vibrations, I could not comprehend the possibility of another world of life and form and feature about and around us. When we can come to realize our own limitations, we can then find room in our minds for something greater and beyond the boundaries set up by our limited physical sense organs. About and around us, interpenetrating this physical world, there is another world into which we pass at death. It has been described to me by those who have spoken to me from it, but only in language suited to our finite minds. When asked how best to explain it to others, I was told to Compare it to a sea of ether, wherein personal movement is even more rapid and easy than that of a fish in water.